The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We have a really interesting 2 hours coming up. We have two very interesting writers in a very broad sense, in a narrow sense as well, from the Arab American community here in our country to talk about their work. We're going to be talking to Michael Corbin, who teaches in the state prisons, is one of our urbanite stories. And then you're going to hear an hour's worth of an interview with James McBride, who wrote the book Song Gets Sung. So stay with us. In order to do that, you got to stay safe, drive safe, get home safe, and we'll turn this over to WEAA traffic so you can do that. We'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by TalkRadioPro.net. Information regarding your own online radio program can be obtained at TalkRadioPro.net.
Delays easing on 895 southbound, still jammed up in the southwest corner because of the crash on 95. Update brought to you by Advil. The crash out of the way on 895 southbound after the Harbor Tunnel. 895 northbound between the Route 3 spur and the Harbor Tunnel, delays remain. Right lane blocked on 95 southbound at the Beltway in Arbutus. It's jammed from the Fort McHenry Tunnel. Outer loop before Hollins Ferry Road, crash with a reported overturned tractor trailer blocking in the left lane. Outer loop slow from 70 with an accident at Wilkins Avenue off to the left shoulder. Inner loop, the ramp to the BW Parkway southbound, there's a stalled vehicle. Closure in Catonsville, rolling road at Wilkins Avenue in both directions because of a crash that took down a pole and wires. Expect that closure to last through rush hour. York at Ridgely for another accident in the county. Anne Arundel County, BW Parkway northbound at 100. Watch for a ladder in the roadway. Motorcycle-involved accident 648 at Pasadena Road. And a crash in Annapolis, Taylor Avenue at Rowell Boulevard. Inner loop of the Beltway. On and off delays right now between Park Heights and Providence. Outer loop delays Hartford to the Harrisburg Expressway. Brought to you by Advil. Get the facts and join the millions who count on Advil for relief. Relief doesn't get any better than this. Advil. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. And before we get into the heart of our discussion, I want to remind you all that we had a conversation with Baltimore City Public Schools today, and they want to make sure that all high school students are in school and doing what they should be doing and having some interesting new chances. So what they're doing is they're putting on these workshops and discussions so that parents and students can come and give you all the options that you might want to consider in terms of where you want to go to school and the kinds of courses you can take, because every course is not for everybody, and you can help redesign your own life in our Baltimore City schools and take part in this because I know our schools are going in a new direction. And there are also options here for people, students who left school and want to return. So here's the information. This Saturday, September 26th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Success Academy at 200 East North Avenue is when the session will be. They're holding the fair, and it'll be a fair for all that morning. More information can be had at 443-984-2000. That's 443-984-2000. So if you know a student who has dropped out of school, who once he gets back in school, who want to consider how to put their lives whole again and come back to our city school system, see what your options are. Don't miss this Saturday at 200 East North Avenue, Success Academy. That's the old Baltimore City School headquarters, the old Poly building on North Avenue. Call 443-984-2000. Put your life back together or help someone else do that and sail right through the Baltimore City School system. We are joined in studio right now by Kim Jensen, who's been on my show before, for the novel she wrote, The Woman I Left Behind, which was a love story set in Palestine between an American woman and a Palestinian. She's also the author of a new collection of poetry called Bread Alone. And Jalul Marbrook is with us as well. Jalul is the author of a poetry collection called Far From Algiers. And his new novel is Saraceno. I have that right?
Saraceno.
And they both join us here. They'll both be, by the way, reading their poetry and talking about their books this Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Creative Cafe at the Baltimore Book Festival down on Mount Vernon. We'll be down there, too, so join us down there. WEA has a table. You should come on down and meet these fine people and hear what they have to read. And it's good to have you both with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both of you with us, I should say. When Kim sent me her book, this new poetry book that she sent before it was published, and I went through it and talked about having it come in the air, you know, and I know your deep connection to the Arab-American world and to the Palestinian world, I said it would be interesting to have you come on, maybe even bring another writer on who comes out of the Arab-American world and talk about why you write and where it comes from and read some of your poetry. And you suggested Jalul, and I know Del from the workshops we did together the last couple of years at the Baltimore Book Festival and never put the two together about Jalul. Oh, that's an Arab name, but I never thought about it. So, So welcome. Good to have you both here.
Thank you.
Talk a bit about, first of all, as a novelist, I mean, it looks like you went from your novel to poetry, and you went from your poetry to novels, at least in my knowing of your two works. So talk a bit about that, Kim.
Well, when my first novel came out, it was somewhat experimental, and there was a lot of poetry in there. And poetry is actually the first thing that I started writing, and I've never given up on it. It's definitely really important to me. And so as I was writing the novel, even, I was creating poetry. And so to me, they're not that disconnected, just a different genre, different form, but ultimately going, you know, the form of self-expression is very similar.
And Jalul, you've been a writer for a long, long time. I mean, you're a newsman for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And have written many things. So, and this is, you have your new novel is out, Saracino, and this is a...
Actually, it came out before the Book of Poems.
Oh, did it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the publisher went belly up right as he was about to distribute it.
That makes it tough.
But that's an old story.
So, talk a bit about the book poetry, Far From Algiers, that you wrote.
Well, Far From Algiers, you know, I had written poetry since I was 14, but I stopped in my 30s because I had this kind of revelation about my own poetry. It was quite experimental, and I thought it was quite avant-garde, and I was very influenced by the James Schuyler and Frank O'Hara. But at some point, because I was going through a personal crisis, I realized that I was hiding behind my poetry, that I really didn't want to be caught dead meaning what I said or saying what I meant. And when I realized that about myself, it was so appalling that I just flat stopped writing poetry, and I didn't start again until the terrorist attacks at 9/11. And even then, I didn't realize I was writing poetry. I was just walking around Manhattan, walking down to Ground Zero in a daze like most New Yorkers, and I began taking notes. And in a few days, I realized that my notes were actually lines of poetry. At first, I just really didn't see that. And then I realized that I was writing very differently, from a very different perspective, after having lived a fairly long time. I'm 75 now. And Far From Algiers just came from a stack of poems I had in my dining room. I think there were 15 stacks, each with a certain theme. The theme might be death or transition. And one of those themes was alienation, the feeling that immigrants have often of being not quite welcome. And that's the genesis of Far From Algiers, that one stack among 14 others.
You were born in Algiers, right?
I was, yes.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you came here to this country?
I wasn't a year old yet. I was born in Algiers. My mother was a German-American artist. My father was a Bedouin from eastern Algeria. And they had a falling out, and my mother took me to America. Her home.
Interesting. So why don't we kind of flavor of both your works for a moment? And look like you have your book open, so I'll turn to Kim Jensen first. And Kim, your book is entitled Bread Alone.
It's entitled Bread Alone, and my book of poetry also came out of a really specific time in history, which was These poems primarily started being written in 2007 after Saddam Hussein was hung. And I started also writing these really intense, kind of graphic, sad, pretty grim poems that are pretty political. And little by little, they started forming a unit, and that's how this book came about. So there's a lot of poems in there here that have to do with the Arab world, the attack on the Arab world, Palestine, Iraq, Lebanon. So if you, I guess it's appropriate to start with one of those types of poems in here. This one is called "The Mask Has Fallen." Every time I hear them use the word freedom, I see it, the whole procession of nails, the carnival of rusty iron spikes raised at the ready, green clouds, catastrophic weeping, the final transgression of braided fields and meadows, whole forests collapsing into powdery erosions, of broken trumpets and punctured drums. And then the desert rewinds into itself, into the coil of the rattle. And they know what they're saying, and they know what they have done.
Who are you writing that to?
Well, to me, I thought it was pretty obvious about the word freedom, which is so overused. And the word freedom is supposed to evoke for us just a general sensation of happiness and freedom, but it became used in such a jingoistic way and in such a xenophobic way that it was like Orwell. All the meaning was sucked out of it, and all I could see when every time the politicians would use that word were these horrific apocalyptic images.
I like that. Why don't you read through and find us another one while we turn to Jalul and have him pick something from Far From Algiers. And
I was responding to that same kind of nativist response that you saw. I was appalled at how the terrorist attacks had brought out the nativism that we're usually in denial about. And then on top of the nativism, of course, just plain xenophobia.
And I've read Jalul's poetry, by the way, which I really admire. And I also, as I was reading, you mentioned the word alienation, and the word otherness came out to me a lot.
Yes.
The sense, not only a sort of identity otherness, but otherness within ourselves, the fact that it's really very difficult. And that's, I guess, the work of the poet, to try and create a wholeness where there is no wholeness. I didn't take your poems as overtly political, but I felt this deep-rooted kind of sense of, like you said, not being welcome, or a sense of distance from the world that came out. Is that true?
Oh, yes, I think so. And there's not a dime's worth of difference between the alienation that an Arab American might be feeling in our society and an American Jew and anti-Semitism. It's the same damn thing. There's no difference. And other immigrant groups have experienced it as well, the Irish, the Sicilians. But our response was so embittered and irrational, I thought, to the attacks, and still is for that matter. Should I read a short poem?
Please do.
This one's called "Solemn Rider." The little girl rides her mother's back in a sling, listening to her mother's heart, taking the measure of her mother's day with the solemnity of a doctor. In this intimacy, there is more hope for us than in religions and philosophies.
See, your words. It's the words of comes from a pen that's been penning things for a long time and playing with this language for a long, long time.
I've actually held the language in my hand as an editor when we were using hot type and you could actually hold a headline in your hand.
That's wild. That's definitely a different era. But I mean, just that piece right there, I mean, and what it says about what we miss and what maybe is important in our own humanity. You know, what we're not, what we're always seeing beyond the obvious.
Well, you know, what Kim was saying about the role that we have cast the Arab into, it's an old role. The Arabs have been playing the role of the dark other in Western civilization for a long time, and they're aware of it. I mean, we have regarded the Saracens as the dark other, and we've demonized them for a very... In fact, there's a famous 13th century tapestry that shows the Saracens fighting the Franks, and they're wearing devil's tails and horns, and that's because they're mocking the Franks for having demonized them.
Oh, this is
a 13th century tapestry,
but an Ottoman, a Turkish tapestry.
It's actually a French tapestry.
It's a French tapestry.
Yeah, and I mean, the Arabs are well aware that we have been demonizing them for a very long time.
It's funny, you know. I mean, Europeans did the same thing to the Jews.
Yes,
tails,
exactly.
Horns,
exactly.
The devil, right. Dracula. I mean, Dracula was all about these anti-Semitic tales that they wanted to create.
And you know, when the Arabs call this war that we've waged in Iraq a crusade and call us crusaders, we might pause and remember that the first official act of the first crusade, the very first crusade, was to kill 5,000 Jews in the Rhine Valley. That was their first official act. Then they went on to Constantinople and killed a lot of Christians. Then they went on and killed a lot of Arabs.
Right. I was going to say about the tapestry, of course, you said it's a 13th century tapestry. That's right in the middle of the Crusades. And often the dehumanization or the dehumanizing images that you see go hand in hand with actual policies of aggression or militarism or colonialism. Exactly. So these images just aren't Hollywood bad guy things. These go hand in hand with governmental and corporate policies.
So what the two of you are talking about right now, and we're talking about the way with Kim Jensen, you just heard, Jalou Marbrook, both writers, poets. They'll be appearing at 3 o'clock this Saturday at the Baltimore Book Festival at the Creative Tent. We'll be there that afternoon as well doing some interviews. And James McBride, who will hear next hour, will be there on Sunday afternoon at noon. It's going to be just chock full. You want to spend the weekend at the book festival, I think, if you have a chance. The idea that you're talking about these social issues that face humankind, I mean, is part of the poetry that you write. I mean, some people write poetry out of a much more deeply personal place in terms of its being about love and relationships. But the poetry so far I'm hearing is a poetry that's kind of fueled by a different kind of passion.
Well, I think that's because, for me at least, I'm talking, you know, to the theme of having come from a half-Arab background. But as a poet, I mean, I wouldn't really want to cast myself as an Arab-American poet because I really didn't grow up in an Arab culture. In fact, I grew up in a very waspish culture, actually. But for me, I view poems as forensics and algorithms, and they help me understand what I have witnessed. They help me come to terms with it, and they help me gather up my experience, and in some ways it's like detective work. Now, of course, I'm 75 years old, so if I were a younger poet, that probably would not be my approach. But now, these poems sort of give me an algorithm for understanding my life and my encounters with culture.
And I would add to that for those of us who are poets who are also involved in the anti-war movement or in liberational movements or human rights movements, these issues are very personal.
Right.
It's hard to not to live in a world such as we live in, and if you care and if you think and you're involved and you're active, that absorbs into you and it comes out in what you write. The preface to my book talks about how really for me, personally, the Bush era was an era of despair, and that's very much reflected in the book. That doesn't mean that all the poems are political. There's a lot of very personal ones. There's some love poems in there.
You want to read a couple now?
Well, the one that I have open here is personal and political. How about that?
That sounds good. That's good.
It feels kind of Baltimore, but it's definitely a universal sort of, it's got a lot in it. It's called Long Shelf Life. We became accustomed to a world without water, grew at home in a world without gardens. We raised our children on the prospects of cardboard and more wars. Our daily bread was leavened with the excretion of combustion engines, enriched with the residue of uranium. For 18 years, we lectured on the merits of public schools, but lived and died beneath a cloud of human ash, and often drove past men with gangrenous lesions, hobbling through well-lit avenues. We were content with our sins of omission, and came to believe there was no difference between past and present, hell and heaven.
Mm. That's powerful.
I know it's rather grim. It's not. This book came out today on my doorstep, and I don't know how to feel about it because truly, it's a record of a lot of unhappy years. And in that way, it's not necessarily a cause for celebration. But I can say it's true. I can say I look at these poems and I say there's a lot of truth for me in there.
Well, we turn to Jalil Sidel for a minute to read something. Find something else.
Something more cheerful?
No. Anything you like, I'm just.
All right.
I'm going to define what you're supposed to do here. Jalil?
Well, this poem is called Embassy. And, you know, the General Assembly has been meeting in New York.
They have been.
And maybe this poem is sort of.
And the 90-minute Gaddafi speech.
Oh yes, what a speech!
He is such a freak. I just love. I just laugh every time. Not at him, but he's just.
Although
very
I do
interesting
think he
character.
Had a point about the Security Council. Actually,
he had a lot of good points. Yeah. But he's just even his way he, his garb is like this, his kind of his own design of Bedouin garb. You know what I mean? I mean, he's a very interesting character. Okay, go ahead.
I don't know enough about anything to be anybody but a stranger. Isn't that what a respectful visitor would say to a worried host? Of course, we kept our daughters out of sight, but we found no fault with him. Say this of me, I'll find no fault with you when I am asked about your country.
Hmm.
Mm. And what fueled that poem?
I'm darned if I know more.
if I talked to you after you'd written a few days before, you might remember. So when you read it, what does it fuel now for you then?
Well, you know, when I finish a poem, or that is when I think it's finished, because sometimes it takes me a long time, sometimes not. I'm just sort of glad if it comes out right, because many of them don't. But very often when I go back and revisit them months or even years later, I say, gee, I didn't know that. Hmm. Or I didn't know I knew that. Or I didn't know that I felt that way. So that's why I view them as forensics, really, for helping me figure out, you know, the mysteries in my life, because I've always had the feeling, or at least not always, but I've had the feeling since I was in my 30s, that you can't get on with the rest of your life if you don't do something about the baggage that you've already acquired. You have to somehow come to some understanding about, you know, what you have in your attic, and then go on.
That's true.
I was going to say about Jalil's poetry. I see why he calls his poems like forensics. I would say they're also archaeological. His poems have a lot of different layers to them, and they can be read in a multiplicity of ways. They're very multivalenced. I find them very rich and textured. So, and that's tough. You can tell that these are highly crafted poems that take a long time to put together.
They're chewable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nothing crunchy. Like what I would have. What I was writing when I was younger, no.
So why don't you pick another piece before we take a break?
Okay. Here's one that appears toward the end of the book. It's called Hello. After 40 days of fasting in the desert, you stumble out of the parking lot into the wilderness. Rows and rows of identical cream townhomes and condos crowded so close, they look as though squeezed from a tube. It's a place where the word becomes flesh-colored stucco, intends to produce its own echo. An invisible map called How to Live has been built into each interior wall. You've been sleeping on the floors of caves without reference point for so long. You think it might help to follow some simple instructions. This is a balcony. Don't fall.
I love that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
I like that a lot.
Sometimes the answers are simple. We just don't read the signs right.
Many answers are simple, but we don't read the signs right.
Or we don't want to know.
Right.
I think that's what happened in the Bush years, actually.
We don't.
A large number of Americans didn't want to know, didn't want to think.
Right, right. You want to close out for a little bit and be one more piece for us?
Well, I was talking about forensics, so I'll read you a sort of forensic poem. It's called The Strait of Claws. What if we had Napoleon's fingerprints or Zenobia's biologicals? Would they tell us more than politics? What would we do without the dead, the magic they do and have become? They have their hands in everything. I feel them breathing on my neck, creatures to whom we're primitives, they see by each other's light. How would we navigate the dark without the light of their thoughts running their fingers through our minds? They ensorcel me with the spices of their ideas and fairy touch. I aspire to be evidence of them. Heedless of their shape as clouds and as ingenious, they have been fitting me for passage through the Strait of Claws. Our opinions are such soft pajamas, forensics won't persuade us to give them up. Besides, the police are corrupt.
Oh my God. There's some great lines in there.
I love that. Now, when did you write that one?
Actually, that's a pretty new one.
I love that one.
I was thinking, gee, you know, if Mark asked me to read something, I think I should read this poem.
Thank you.
Did you just say our opinions are soft pajamas?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a bit.
I like that. We'll see you Saturday.
I hope so. That would be great.
3 o'clock.
Looking forward to it.
The Creative Cafe, the Baltimore Book Festival, to meet both Kim Jensen and Jalul Marbrook. Kim's poetry book we're reading from today is called Bread Alone. The novel she wrote when we first met was called The Woman I Left Behind. Jalul Marbrook's poetry book is called Far From Algiers. And I love this poetry book. I read it often, and I'll probably do the same with Kim's now that I have it. And his novel that I have not yet read, but I'm looking forward to, is Saraceno, that we got in the mail as well. And you can meet both of them. I'll be reading and talking with you all. Don't miss that. Go to the Baltimore Book Festival and support your poets and writers and read a lot and write a lot. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks so much for having us. Great to have you in the studio.
On our way to a break and to introduce you to Michael Corbin, who teaches in prison here in Baltimore, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back, so don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and as many of you know, the Urbanite magazine is our print partner, and we take many of the stories they have every month, and we turn them into conversations on the air and into audio stories and documentaries, and I do the question and answer in the beginning of each month's issue. This month's issue is about education and learning, and I want to remind you, as on the way to talk to Michael Corbin, who teaches in our prisons. Before that, he was a public school teacher here in Baltimore. He wrote the article, Learning the Hard Way, in this month's issue. We're going to talk about his experiences teaching in a prison. Reminding you, the Urbanite Radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Marin Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season, featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhof are available at 410-783-8000. Or go to bsomusic.org. And Michael Corbin, welcome. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Thanks for having me.
A return. You were here a bunch of years back talking about school testing when you were a public school teacher.
Another education issue.
One of the things that struck me about this story that you wrote is the fact that you were a public school teacher, decided to go to prison, to teach in prison. We'll talk about why in a minute. But it seems like one of the most poignant experiences for you in the joint teaching is the fact that you see so many of your students from public school who are now in prison, or see people who are their uncles or their fathers or their brothers or whatever. And that's a very frightening and powerful thing here. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, and it probably was the original impulse to write about my experience, literally to see a former student that I taught in prison, and then to see another and then another. And then the students that I do teach, I could say, where'd you go to school? You know, Lake Clifton, Northwestern, Walbrook. And I would know some of their teachers. I would know their experiences. And yet we're in prison together. And, you know, it became a very emotional thing. Like, what is this? What's going on here? And so I, you know, reflect on it. And it's personal for me in that I had these personal relationships with some of those students. But then you see the kind of tragic failure of something going on in our society where these young men are filling up the prison. And it just needed to give some kind of voice to that.
Now, I mean, and you talk about this one young man that you met immediately. When you saw him walk in the room, you knew him.
Yes.
And you remembered him as a skinny young adolescent kid, as you write. But here he was, this young, well-muscled, multi-tattooed young guy who's coming in there for a year.
Yes.
And that shook you more than the others for some reason.
Well, it was personal. I mean, it was that personal dimension to it. Teaching requires, I guess you don't have to do it as a teacher, but I think successful teaching requires a kind of really personal involvement. And also, I think teaching, particularly in urban public schools, you know the kind of odds that you're up against. And to develop a relationship with someone where your whole mission is to keep from happening what did happen in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then to experience that, and also teaching in prison, my mission in part is to say, hey, well, these still don't have to be the same paths that you walk. And yeah, I mean, in the article, I said it made me sick. You know, it makes me sick on that personal level for that young man. But it also is a kind of visceral feeling that there's something fundamentally wrong in our country, it's fundamentally wrong in our city, that's producing this reality. I mean, it's so easy to pass it off as some kind of he made the wrong choice, sort of individual narratives of failure, success, whatever. But the scale of it is just too massive for it to just be that. When everybody in my class is straight out of Baltimore City Public Schools, what is that saying? Is it that they're all bad? And, you know, on the larger scale, you know, we incarcerate more than any other country in the world. There's a handful of white guys over at MTC. And unless you want to hold some really regressive notions about race and incarceration and criminality, you have to say, wait a minute, there's a huge failure here.
We're talking right now with Michael Corbin, who teaches in the prison here in Baltimore City. He wrote an article called Learning the Hard Way in this month's issue of Urbanite magazine. This is one of our Urbanite radio story series. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow at gmail.com. Jump on to the Mark Steiner Show page on Facebook and join the conversation there. But 410-319-8888. So why did you make that leap? Why did you make the leap? It's not in the article, so I'm curious. Why did you make the leap from teaching public school to teaching in prison, which is such a very different place? And in some ways, you're even more confined in what you can teach in prison because you're doing GED for the most part during the day, right?
Well, I don't know. I challenge some of those assumptions a little bit. You know,
oh, please do. Come on.
That in some ways, education in urban public schools has become a highly institutionalized rote exercise. And there are so many good things that go on in urban public education and some great teachers. But institutionally speaking, it's become a kind of, it's become a much more bleaker place for teachers, in my opinion. And making the transition to prison, there's different ways to answer your question why I did it. And I guess the best way to answer would be because I want to live in a world where somebody doesn't have to ask me that question because, you know, we are a brother's keeper. You know, that it's what we do. That's what we should do.
I mean, when you work in a prison, one of the things you happens, at least I think it happens to a lot of people who work in prisons, that they are there because they really care about the people they're working with in the prison, is you walk in, this door slams behind you. I mean, you know you're in a jail. And then...
Well, the door slams after you get searched and remove articles of clothing to get in to go teach, yeah.
Right. And then leaving, the door slams behind you, but you're also leaving behind guys that you care about, many of whom you think maybe shouldn't be inside.
Correct. And, you know, on that point, let me give a shout out to all the brothers listening to in the dormitory at MTC tonight. Sure. For the national figures, and I think it's true for MTC, about two-thirds are nonviolent drug offenders. I teach an afternoon class where nobody is over 25, and a couple guys are 18, 19 years old. They're hugely talented. They were petty drug dealers involved in the life, in the game. And they're incarcerated, some of them, for a number of years. And it's not clear that their life chances... it is clear that their life chances will be severely inhibited because of this experience. And because of the experiences before the prison. Don't get me wrong. It's not that you absolve anybody of their previous acts, decisions. But the question is, you know, is the institution itself providing something else for them? Or is that the mission? In America today, it's not the mission of the prison to do that. It is hard to go into prison and teach, to come back around to your question. It's difficult for me every day to go in there and see what's nothing less than a kind of human warehousing, the waste of human potential that's there. It gets very emotional and psychically exhausting, yes.
You teach both this daytime program that is voluntary for men to come into or not, which is largely for GED, right?
Correct.
And you teach in the evenings college courses.
Well, that's temporarily no longer existing. I pushed to attempt to have a college program. There's a number of men in prison with high school diplomas that get nothing else. I mean, there really is no post-secondary option. There are some people that support it. I mean, really, college programs went out of prison in the mid-90s after Pell Grants were taken away from incarcerated
so that
men.
So that people incarcerated could pay for their college education.
Correct. Well, and so that institutions could come in and get that Pell Grant money and provide an institutional framework for college post-secondary ed.
Well, I mean, talk about that for a minute. I mean, one of the things that really struck me here, and I want to talk about some of the men that you met in this idea of being a separate America, because I really want to get to those two points, but one of the things, I mean, when I taught in the prisons, which was back in the 70s, Pell Grants did exist. And men who really wanted to do something with their lives really took advantage of that and ended up, if they went to minimum security, being allowed to have a day pass to go to a junior college after the first year and take classes, whether the college students come back to the joint at night, and then actually go to regular college when they left. And a lot of people turned lives around. I mean, you don't realize what a dead end it is. I don't think people really understand how much of a dead end it is for these men in that place.
It's a dead end. It absolutely is. Now, I mean, there are people who don't want it to be that way. But in America today, in Maryland today, in Baltimore today, prison is a way to perpetuate a kind of pariah class in American society because it is such a dead end. There will be success stories. There will always be success stories.
Always.
You know, same thing with urban public education. Some wonderful student will go to Harvard and it will be used to justify everything that's done in urban public education. The vast majority of human beings that get processed through the prison system will live lives of quiet desperation, and sometimes not quiet desperation thereafter.
This story may resonate with some of you out there listening at 410-319-8888. Some of you maybe have worked in prison. Some of you maybe have done time in prison. Some people just have a thought about what education means in our prison system. We'd love to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We're talking with Michael Corbin, who teaches in a prison, MTC, a prison in Baltimore City, and he's author of the article Learning the Hard Way in this month's issue of Urbanite magazine, 410-319-8888. In the article, you talk about this being a separate, I don't think you, I'm using the word parallel. I don't think you use the word parallel.
I did. A separate and parallel world, yeah.
For America.
A separate and parallel America.
Yeah. Talk about that concept from your perspective.
Well, and this would connect with, I think, the public education experience and why, I mean, I teach many of the same kids, and literally and institutionally speaking, like a lot of my students in public school lived in a separate world. They went to Baltimore City Public Schools, which are kind of an apartheid school system. It's a majority black system, not just majority black, but almost completely black school system, one of the most segregated in the country. But then they also went back to hyper-segregated communities by race and class. And those students that I taught in public school are connected to many of the men that I teach in prison who are also part of this separate America. It's not just the sort of traditional notion of the ghetto that's separate from America, but there's a kind of parallel world that has gone on here. It's not just no longer they are seen as the underclass that will be brought into the mainstream over time, particularly, you know, in these economic times, but they exist kind of in a separate world, a parallel world to ours that I don't think many people even recognize. We think of it as, you know, sort of just the criminal element or just the drug trade, but it's much more than that. It's whole lives, whole communities, whole cultures.
You talk in the article about really interesting, a lot of stuff in this article. It's just, a lot of pieces in here that could be developed into much larger pieces. When you talk about the men that you went to speak to across the yard, and you talked about the older heads in the joint who, and the organizations that people have formed inside the prison, and how even looking at these very bright, organized, tough black men, on the outside would be a huge threat to be seen. Talk about what that process is, what you talked about there. And your thoughts on maybe some things you didn't share with us in this article.
Yeah, I think inside prison life, inside the prison, the fact that there are no large-scale programmatic responses for rehabilitation. In fact, there's both an implicit and an explicit belief that rehabilitation is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That prison is really about just simply about punishment and a kind of vengeful punishment. You know, you're going into this hole in the ground. You're going into this wastebasket. Well, the reality is human beings are going to, like, create their own meaning and social organization in that environment. And the meaning and social organization that these men create are things that probably would scare and frighten you know, middle-class Americans. Sometimes, you know, I mean, we think the sort of shorthand we use is gang life. They're gangs. But and when we think of gangs, we just think of this sort of criminal activity, this criminal enterprise. But really, it's so much more sophisticated than that. Like, as a teacher, you know, if I get a black guerrilla family member who's 18 years old come into my classroom, you know, I have to approach him as someone who's his all of his reading material, all of his understanding of ethical context in the world is developed in this gang structure, this family structure. They can be very regressive organizations, but they can also provide the real sustenance and meaning to men. And it's the only thing that they got going in prison. I think we don't – if we have to take gangs seriously as cultures unto themselves that have developed partly in prison but partly in this separate America. And if we just continue to attack them as merely criminal enterprises, we miss their substance, I think.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. I apologize to those listeners who just called in and hung up. We'll take your calls as soon as you call back at 410-319-8888. Michael Corbin teaches in our state prison system at MTC here in Baltimore. He's author of the article Learning the Hard Way in this month's issue of Urbanite magazine. One of the things that, I mean, there's this question you raise about morality in your article, and there's not much of a differentiation between the street and the prison in a lot of ways. I mean, one's an extension of the other.
I do think that. And I think you see that partly through those social organizations that move in and out of the prison. But also, I guess, one of the things that I wanted to try to convey in there is that a lot of the young men don't see a qualitative difference, that like their interaction with civic institutions before prison might have been the police and a dysfunctional public school, maybe some kind of social service system, and their experience of civic life in prison is the police, some limited social service system, and a limited educational system. So it's qualitatively the same experience for them. I mean, psychologically, the same experience. So I think like we wonder, like, well, if you get out of prison, we'll join mainstream society or go back to being a good citizen. Well, but if it's kind of a transparency, if there's kind of a permeable membrane between those two worlds, you don't necessarily think that way.
So, I mean, I was really taken by some of the people that you described in the prison. Some of the men you talked about. I mean, it seems you're very taken with these guys. You have a real relationship with them.
Don't all teachers have relationships with their students?
Yeah, they do. Absolutely, they do. But what I mean is these are the reason I say that is because you even mentioned yourself in the article. These are men who in some senses would frighten many people who would want to come in and teach him work, you know. But there's a respect you have for them and as human beings that is that's pretty profound, I think.
Well, yes, I do believe that's a prerequisite for teaching. I mean, that's why I teach. It's why I taught in Baltimore City Public Schools, and why I teach now. The other reality is that teaching in prison, you meet some of the hungriest intellectual men students you'll ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I'll have guys that, you know, they can't wait to get the next book. You know, I mean, you know how difficult it was for me teaching adolescents sometimes and trying to get them to read and you know, turn off the TV or the iPod or whatever and hook them onto reading. Well, you know, I got guys that will physically accost me as I walk in across the yard in the morning and say, what's to read? You know, the engagement with very deep and profound ideas. You know, Malcolm X said there were two places in America to go to get an education, and that was the university and prison. And there are some guys that take that really seriously. You know, if you have nothing to do with your time, and there are some amazing transformation stories. You know, the one brother I do talk about in there, a Muslim who student who essentially taught himself to speak Arabic. You know, this is a guy who grew up on the streets of Baltimore, who reads the Quran every day in Arabic, prays in Arabic, speaks to his Muslim brothers in Arabic, and studies everything. I mean, he was just insatiable. And I think that's in some ways, in part, the prison experience. And as a teacher, my God, you know, like that's what you live for, you know.
That's what you want in a student. Let's go to the phones, get the folks in here calling in at 410-319-8888. And Michael, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi, Michael.
I've been listening to your show. I pretty much turned it on. And I worked in the prison system on and off about 20 years. I'm a psychologist of this. And what we fail to understand, or what most people fail to understand, is these people are humans in themselves. And they should not be looked upon by what they did and why they're there, but the fact that while they're there, they can possibly and hopefully get rehabilitated. And a teacher like this gentleman, and God bless you, my friend, for what you're doing. I appreciate it and commend you for what you're doing. That if we have more people like that, then more people get out of prison being better people and not just better criminals. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your words. Thanks for you working in prison, too. I agree. I mean, it's up to 2.3 million Americans, one in 100 Americans incarcerated. And if we don't think that these are brothers and sisters and that rehabilitation is what we really should be after as an institution, then there's something fundamentally wrong in America today.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. And Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi.
Aaron.
I just want to have a question for your guest about what he thinks preventative measures could be based on his experience and the feedback that he's gotten from his students while in the public classroom as well as his students in prison.
Preventative measures.
To keep the young black men out of prison.
Yeah, well, it's a broad question, and if you mean by like an individual teacher in the classroom, I think it's there's, you know, teachers in Baltimore City deserve much praise, and it's very hard work. In some ways, it was much harder work than working in prison. I don't have a lot of discipline problems in my classroom in prison, for example.
right.
But
that's right. Yep.
But it, in some ways, it's more difficult. But the question is, you know, how to engage your students, the young black males. You know, they drop out by the score. We have expulsion policies that will ultimately redound to the prison school. Individual teachers make a huge difference, though. I mean, that's how I'd answer your question. And, you know, maybe to say to you and to answer Mark's question, it is that personal relationship that you can possibly make with that young man to make a fundamental difference. You know, and we need to rethink, I think, what's going on in urban education. We can't just test our way out of an apartheid school system. We can't just test our way out of social inequality.
410-319-8888. David, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi,
gentlemen.
David.
How you doing?
Well, thank you.
Well, I just wanted to touch bases on some of the things that go on inside of the prison. I work throughout the prison also, the prison system, male and female. I run a mentoring program. I run three different mentoring programs. One is called Men Mentoring Men, My Sister's Keeper, and Behind the Walls. I work with them while they're inside the prison, and I try to make it so when they come out, it's a smooth transition by GED, employment, and support systems, family strengthening. These guys can be rehabilitated, and women. But we have to make sure once we start to engage them that we have to stay consistent.
I think you're right.
I would completely agree. And I should, you know, there are a lot of people doing a lot of good work. I think it's not systematic. I think it's mostly people who take it upon themselves, nonprofit organizations, churches, Islamic organizations, mosques. that do this work, that are undetected, that below the radar, that go on all the time. I mean, and one thing that I use as the kind of narrative through the classroom is that I'm teaching to them so that they'll go back out, you know, teach their sons or engage with the other young men. But just on the last point, I mean, what's been clear to me is that the sheer volume of need completely swamps the scattershot, rehabilitative, transitional mechanisms, programs, individuals out there.
Michael Corbin, it's been great to have you on the air. Thank you so much for writing the article in the Urbanite this month, Learning the Hard Way, and joining us this half an hour. We look forward to having you back for more intense discussions with others about our prisons and how to make them right.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you. Good to have you back. Thank you so much. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with a learning issue, featuring reports on the future of high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and the challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations. And we'll remind you to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore, Thursday, October the 8th, from 7 to 10 p.m., sailing from the historic Inner Harbor. Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from soulful jazz artist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket will benefit WEAA, so don't miss the boat. Tickets are available by calling 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628 or online at weaa.org. When we return, we'll be talking with James McBride, the author of A Song Gets Sung, The Color of Water, and The Miracle of Santa Ana. Stay with us. We'll be right back.